57-member jury found no criminal wrongdoing by Sergeant Pete Tutmark, who fatally shot Donald Harold Graham in the torso as Graham struggled to escape from deputies. Graham, a wanted felon with a long history of eluding police, has been on the run for several months. On the evening of December 15th, deputies responded to a phone call encountering Graham outside a Damascus home. Graham struggled as deputies tried to handcuff him, according to Detective Wendy Baps, a spokeswoman for the sheriff's office. Deputies used a taser stun gun, a baton, and a police dog to try to subdue Graham, but he continued to fight and grabbed a rifle carried by Deputy Tom Schaefer, according to Baps. Tutmark then shot Graham. This is the second time that Tutmark, a 22-year veteran of the sheriff's office, has been cleared of wrongdoing in a shooting death in Clackamas County. In March 2002, Tutmark and another deputy fatally shot an armed suicidal man in Estacada. The shooting of Graham was one of three by sheriff's deputies during a two-week period in December.
Oregon threw its hat in the ring almost from the moment the U.S. Education Secretary announced that a handful of states would be chosen to pilot a new approach toward measuring student progress under the No Child Left Behind law. Only a month remains before proposals are due, and education officials in Oregon are scrambling to ready their pitch. Currently, in Oregon and elsewhere, test scores from the third graders of 2004 are compared with the test scores of third graders of 2005. If the 2005 kids turn in significantly higher scores, the school passes muster with the federal government. Oregon will know in April whether its petition to consider growth is approved. If granted, individual student progress would be factored into the No Child Left Behind results calculated for the 2005 to 2006 school year.
Oregon's Death with Dignity law is standing strong today after the Supreme Court ruled 6-3 yesterday that it does not violate federal anti-drug laws. KBOO's Sheila Whiteside reports.
Oregon's Death with Dignity law, the only one in the nation, is still standing. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled Tuesday it does not violate federal anti-drug laws. Oregon attorney Charles Hinkle is co-counsel for the ACLU on the case. He says the ruling effectively ends 8 years of federal interference, at least for now.
It is still possible that Congress could try to get back in the act and expand the Controlled Substances Act or pass some kind of new statute that would effectively preempt the Oregon law.
The Justice Department released a statement saying the ruling is a disappointment and that it will aggressively continue to go after cases where drugs are used illegally. The Death and Dignity laws were approved twice by Oregon voters. As of 2004, just over 200 terminally ill patients ended their lives under the law.
Unless they are specifically prohibited from doing something by the federal government, states have the right to experiment in these areas of social policy.
This is KBOO News. I'm Sheila Whiteside.
Staying with that topic for a minute, after winning the 6-3 Supreme Court decision yesterday, supporters of Oregon's law allowing physician-assisted suicide gained a second unexpected victory, the grudging support of Oregon's Republican Senator Gordon Smith. In 2000, Smith supported legislation that would have blocked the Oregon law by preventing doctors from prescribing lethal doses of federally controlled pain medications. But yesterday, Smith suggested that he would not do so again. Republicans control both chambers of Congress, and they are likely could muster enough votes for legislation that would block the use of the Oregon law. But Smith's apparent about-face could alter the political landscape dramatically in the Senate. Rules allow individual senators to halt legislation, and senior Republicans likely would defer to Smith's wishes. Senator Don Nichols, Republican of Oklahoma, led the charge against the Oregon law in 2000 and nearly succeeded in passing a bill called the Pain Relief Promotion Act. It stalled only when Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, threatened a filibuster that would have tied up the Senate floor shortly before the 2000 election.
The state's largest heating oil distributor is warming to biodiesel and has announced it will offer the fuel to customers by the end of January. First Call Heating and Cooling, a Portland company, will join a handful of other distributors, turning to biodiesel as a way to improve sales and burnish environmental reputations. Heating oil provided the main source of heat for 20% of American households in 1980, according to the Energy Information Administration's Residential Energy Consumption Survey. By 2001, that share had dropped to less than 8% as households switched to electricity or natural gas. Biodiesel, however, could help slow or reverse the decline, at least in Oregon. The state's reputation for environmental awareness has helped create a market for the renewable fuel, which is made from barley, soy, and other crops, as well as waste grease from food service industries. An Oregon Petroleum Association survey conducted last year found that a majority of heating oil customers in Oregon were interested in purchasing biodiesel.
Local activists have begun regular meetings to discuss support for a national class action lawsuit on corporate and government reparations for the descendants of enslaved African and African American workers. Earlier today, KB spoke to an organizer of the effort.
I'm Lisa Loving, and I'm speaking with Troy Muhammad of a local group of activists and organizers who get together on a regular basis to talk about African-American reparations. And Troy Muhammad, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Ms. Loving, for having me on.
Can you tell us a little bit about this regular gathering of activists and what you do?
What we're doing right now is, like I said, community activists from organizations such as Nation of Islam, New Black Panther Party, and other committed and concerned individuals on the plight for reparations for black people. We meet, this is actually our third forum, but we're trying to do it consistently to raise up the issue, to educate the people in the Northwest on the concerns and importance of this reparation push. And we're meeting every couple of weeks for supporters and non-supporters to take part if they have questions or they don't totally understand what the whole purpose for the call for reparations is. And this is why we're meeting. And our next event is the next one's coming up is January 28th.
Can you tell us where that is and what time?
Yes, ma'am. The one at on January 28th, excuse me, will be held at PCC Cascade Jackson Hall building. The doors open up at 1:30 p.m., and that's January 28th, and that's a Saturday. And it's free to the public.
Okay. When it comes to reparations by European and American corporations, as well as governments for people who were the descendants of people who were victimized by being enslaved by corporations, I know that in the past 5 years, research has shown that companies in the United States that currently exist as diverse as like Aetna Insurance Company have been found to have, through written records have been shown to have profited through enslaving people. So I know that there is a factor of this movement that is looking at literally corporate accountability.
Correct.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Correct. That's quite a bit. You name one, and there's, you know, many more lists, U.S. Bank, Bank of America, and the list goes on and on. Those and benefited from trading our ancestors and free labor, chattel slavery per se. And we many of us know the history. This is what we're gathering to meet and educate the public on as well, because many of black people don't understand the importance, and many Caucasians who are the descendants of the slave master, their children don't understand why this is such a strong move and why it's so prevalent and important, not just to the black community, but all overall Americans, because it affects the total country. And so this is why we're gathering like this, to mention those particular names who were involved and to educate the people, because some people don't know the depth of how our people were affected for over 400-some years.
And, two, I know that there's a precedent that's been set over the past, I believe, 10 years specifically, where international law has allowed, I want to say, from what I understand, Japanese-American and even, I think, some Japanese citizens, as well as Jewish-American and Jewish citizens from different countries around the world have been allowed to receive reparations, I think, from
Correct.
Maybe the U.S. government as opposed to corporate entities.
Correct. U.S. government plays a big part, and they're to be held accountable because they're responsible for allowing corporations to participate in this atrocity.
We've been speaking with Troy Muhammad, who, along with a handful of other African-American activists, meets every couple of weeks on the topic of what America and Europe owe and should they pay. Their next meeting is Saturday, January 28th at 1 p.m., Portland Community College, Sylvania Campus, Jackson Hall. For more information, reach Mr. Muhammad at 503- 504 1-800-799-0409. I'm Lisa Loving, KBOO News.
Just a small correction on that story. The Reparations Group meets January 28th at 1:30 at the Portland Community College Cascade campus in Jackson Hole.
Organizers of the effort to kill public campaign financing in Portland yesterday delivered the signatures needed to put the issue on the citywide May ballot. The First Things First committee handed in over 40,000 signatures in favor of repealing what is considered to be the nation's most comprehensive public financing system. That's about 14,000 more signatures than they need to get the initiative before voters on May 16th. The city elections officer has 30 days to certify the signatures, but their delivery marked the beginning of the campaign. Repeal organizers have honed a central message asking, why are city leaders so eager to spend taxpayer money on political campaigns when they are struggling to find money for basic services such as parks, public safety, and schools? However, the Portland City Council does not pay for public education. State election officials are investigating complaints that signature gatherers working for the repeal misled people by telling them that public financing would take money directly from schools. Repeal organizers said the signature gatherers mistakenly deviated from their approved sales pitch. Commissioner Eric Sten is one of the architects of public financing and is among seven other candidates trying to qualify.
Food Not Bombs is a local peace group dedicated to social change using the tool of food. Food Not Bombs is actively seeking more community support for its projects. KBOO's Noah Eaton has the story.
What exactly does your local chapter do?
Food Not Bombs here serves 5 days a week, Tuesday through Saturday at 5:30 under the Morrison Bridge. Thursday, Food Not Bombs is currently not serving because we don't have enough drivers. And also here at our house, we do have a food bank that has food on Mondays, Thursdays, and Fridays, which we are still doing. So people are still able to come and get food. We're just not serving hot meals right now.
Obviously, it takes a whole lot of elbow grease and nail polish to prepare those Bain Maries and Salamander grills all week long. So how do you do it?
Well, there are several different houses that are involved doing it, and each different house basically has their own program going on, and they are serving at Colonel Sumner's Park, and I believe that's on Tuesdays and Fridays, and then the other days are still serving at Morrison Park. But I do have phone numbers and we do talk, but it's mostly each house is organizing their own thing and making sure that that information is getting out to the population that we're serving. So that's how it happens. It's not a super organized thing, but it's as organized as we've been able to get.
So I understand that at both local and national levels, your Food Not Bombs has been under much controversy over the many years. For instance, the San Francisco chapter has been arrested over 1,000 times in efforts by the federal government to basically silence your anti-homeless policies. Why do you think Food Not Bombs is so controversial?
You know, I'm not really sure, other than, you know, this organization isn't really an organization. It's not funded by the government. It's not, there's no 501(c)s involved, nonprofit statuses. We don't have food handler permits. We're basically just getting food that is going to be wasted and giving it to people, anybody who needs it. There's no criteria involved in getting the food. So, you know, we don't take names or numbers. You don't have to prove that you're poor. Anybody can eat the food. I'm not really sure, other than it is, it's fairly anti-authoritarian, I guess. It's non-hierarchical. It's, you know, it's just not it's not like the Oregon Food Bank or any other food bank or any other place that's serving food. You don't have to listen to a sermon. You don't have to listen to anything. It's a place for people to get together, talk about what's going on, hang out. It's a social thing as well, and you know, maybe organize things there. I'm not really sure why they're so interested in serving food. It seems kind of ridiculous, but I have had my house raided, and so have several other people in the past 5 years. So I don't know. I'd like them to let us know why we're so interesting.
I understand that you've partnered up with many other progressive-leaning organizations over the years, including Earth First, the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, the Homes Not Jails, In Defense of Animals. So perhaps our lovely listeners would like to hear a little bit about Food Not Bombs' partnerships with these local organizations.
Well, oftentimes what is happening is we are being asked to serve food at different gatherings like that. So you know, we're going and we're bringing food. I have gone to Earth First Rendezvous, our group, and I have done food there, brought food to them. So we're still involved on, you know, on the same level of just bringing food and supporting them in that way, so that if they're having a conference or a gathering or whatever, that people are able to come and still eat food, because a lot of times, you know, people are coming from all over that don't have places to stay, basically, or don't have a lot of money, and so we're just there supporting that with the food still, you know?
So finally, I imagine there's many average Joes and average Janes out there who are listening to this, who are indeed are taking interest in your project, and perhaps the question that they have in their heads is, how could they come out to support you?
Well, right now, we're actually looking for more help. Like I said, we haven't been able to serve food on Thursdays, and we need people who can drive to help pick up the food, and also to cook, and also to drop off the food. Right now, there's about 3 people at our particular house, or our day, Thursday, Monday, that have been pretty overwhelmed with all of this for over about 5 years. And myself in particular, I'm kind of tired, and I'd like to take a break. And I'd also like to spread it out to the community more, because that's how it should be. So we're just asking for people who have a few extra hours. It doesn't take that long, you know, on Mondays or Thursdays to get involved and to help us. We also are looking for donations of money, you know, 50 cents, a dollar here and there. You know, we're serving approximately, I've figured, about 300 to 500 people a week because we have the food bank. And, you know, if everybody just brought a little bit, you know, every time, then we could fund the gas, you know, that it costs. And sometimes we need extra things to cook with. So that would be helpful. And also we run through appliances very quickly right now. We're looking for a stove. And actually we did just receive a donation of a fridge. But those are things that we also need. So basically that's it.
That was Tamara Martineau speaking with Noah Eaton. For more information on Food Not Bombs, call them at 503-288-2102.
The Washington State Legislature held a public hearing yesterday on a gay civil rights bill, with some insisting the measure was a long overdue change to the state's anti-discrimination laws, and others contending it only creates special status for one group of people. The measure would add the language sexual orientation and gender expression or identity to a state law that already bans discrimination in housing, employment, and insurance based on race, gender, age, disability, religion, marital status, and other factors. Supporters told the House State Government Operations and Accountability Committee hearing that all people deserve protection from discrimination in housing and jobs. The bill has been introduced and rejected annually for nearly 30 years in the legislature. The House last year passed the bill 61-37, with 6 Republicans joining 55 Democrats in favor. But it lost by one vote in the Senate, where 2 Democrats, Jim Hargrove of Hokium and Tim Sheldon of Potlatch, joined 23 Republicans in defeating the bill.
Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio news and independent Native news following our newscast. Then at 6, Circle A Radio will look into the history of U.S. government surveillance programs and will speak with Professor Brian Glick, author of The War at Home, Covert Actions Against U.S. Activists and What We Can Do About It, and Lauren Regan of the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene, Oregon. At 7, it's nonstop hip-hop with DJ Audio. Tonight's weather, showers with a high of 48 degrees, or make that a low. And tomorrow, mostly cloudy, although I wouldn't be totally surprised if it rained on us then, too. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
A grassroots group dedicated to women's pregnancy choices is aligning with another pro-choice group for a night of support for reproductive rights in Oregon. KBOO's Doug Guidi reports.
OHSU's chapter of Medical Students for Choice is teaming up with Backline, one of Oregon's leading pregnancy options counseling hotlines, and is hosting Speak Out, I Had an Abortion, a documentary focusing on women's stories about abortion and the voices speaking in favor of it. The movie is directed by Gillian Aldrich and is documenting the stories of 11 women ranging in age from 21 to 85. The film cuts across race, religion, region, class, politics, demonstrating that abortion affects all women. a new documentary. It will be the first time it will be shown in Oregon, right at a time when the anniversary of the landmark Roe versus Wade decision is being honored, but is also being attacked by conservative forces in the country. Aaron Barry Bybee is student coordinator from the Medical Students for Choice and is assisting with the Speak Out presentation.
Definitely. We wanted to do something a little different this year for Roe Week. Usually med students have a week where we show different things up at campus just on OHSU and show other med students and other nursing students or health profession people about various things. But this year we wanted to have a community action because we just felt...
Medical Students for Choice has about 40 members at OHSU. Backline itself is a new organization founded in 2004. Based in Portland, it was founded in response to the growing need for women and their loved ones to be able to access confidential, anonymous, client-centered pregnancy options, discussion, and post-abortion emotion support. Their toll-free national talk line went live on November 1, 2004. The new organization is evidence that a new generation of women are becoming more aware of their rights to have abortions. Aaron Barry Bybee.
I definitely feel that when I work with people in this community and work with people specifically at Backline, just kind of a, 20s, 30s-year-old people, kind of the threat of losing that is very hitting home and is very scary because we have grown up in a time where we always had the choice. We've always had it. I was born in the early 80s. I've never known anything but reproductive choice, and the idea that that's taken away.
Speak Out, I Had an Abortion will be showing at the Clinton Street Theater in Southeast Portland on Thursday at 7 p.m. For more information, contact Backline at 1-888-493-0092. I'm Doug Weedy, KBOO News.
Governor Ted Kulongoski announced yesterday that he's working on a plan to ensure that more Oregon children have health coverage. Speaking before healthcare industry leaders in Portland, Kulongoski offered few specifics of his Healthy Kids plan. The Democrat said the details would come in his State of the State speech in February. His comments come less than a week after former Governor John Kitzhaber decided against challenging the incumbent in the Democratic primary. Kitzhaber, a former emergency room doctor who helped create the Oregon Health Plan, considered a political comeback partly because of his frustration over health care in Oregon and the nation. More than 75,000 low-income people have been dropped from the Oregon Health Plan since Kulongoski's election in 2002. Yesterday, Kulongoski called for restoring full funding of tobacco use prevention dollars that were approved by Oregon voters but later cut by the legislature, and reiterated his proposal to expand the Oregon Prescription Drug Program.
Dozens of teenagers and adults spoke out yesterday against plans to eliminate the middle schools that feed into Jefferson High School and to require school uniforms for the neighborhood's high school students. The testimony came at a Portland School Board hearing on a community design team's plan to improve student achievement and enrollment at the North Portland High School and the schools that feed into it. Superintendent Vicki Phillips opened the hearing by presenting standardized test scores for Jefferson High and Ockley Green and Tubman Middle Schools, showing their performance ranks near the bottom of all Oregon schools. Under the plan, Jefferson would split into three schools, including an Arts and Technology Academy, an International Baccalaureate and Environmental Studies Academy, and a Young Men's Leadership Academy. Tubman would become a 7th through 12th grade Young Women's Leadership Academy focused on science and technology. And most elementary schools that feed into Jefferson would change to kindergarten through 8th grade schools. Uniforms would be required of all high school students in the Jefferson neighborhood.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 18th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203, or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Noah Eaton. Special thanks to reporters Noah Eaton, Lisa Loving, Doug Guidi, and Sheila Whiteside. Our engineer is Brian Averill. The Cable Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Afifa Ahmed Shafi. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow morning at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Joanne Bowman and Dave Maza co-host Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. They'll interview Danny Bell, publisher of Our Beloved Community Journal, about the Northwest Job Gap Study released this week. One question for discussion, what constitutes a living wage? At 9 on the radio zine Pairfaggering, interviews John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. At 9:30, it's Teresa Mitchell with Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, Mia Kim presents a documentary on U.S. soldiers on War and Peace. At 10:30, Julie Bernard's guest on Art Focus is J.D. Perkin, who will talk about a new show at the former Portland Zoo in St. John's that features large-scale wood constructions made from materials scavenged from a house fire, the River's Edge, a demolished Safeway store, and the Rebuilding Center. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us. Have a good evening.
This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, January 18, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. A new report indicates that the Bush administration's policy of abuse is undermining human rights worldwide. In a government riddled with scandal, Democrats unveil their version of lobbying reform. And activists in Argentina denounce their government's plans to privatize environmental services. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Violent unrest in Ivory Coast continues into its third day. Four government protesters are dead and 10 others are wounded following today's clashes with UN forces. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
In the face of the clashes with the protesters, more than 300 United Nations peacekeepers from Bangladesh have withdrawn from two towns in western Ivory Coast. The protesters are supporters of President Laurent Gbagbo. They are opposed to the dissolution of the country's parliament, which is dominated by President Gbagbo's loyalists. UN-appointed international mediators have recommended the dissolution of the parliament as a way of ending the divided country's crisis. President Gbagbo's party, the Ivorian Popular Front, yesterday announced its withdrawal from the interim government and the peace process. African Union President Olusegun Obasanjo of Nigeria has scheduled an emergency trip to Ivory Coast to attempt to mediate the ongoing crisis. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
The Supreme Court ruled today that a lower court was wrong to strike down a New Hampshire law that requires minors to notify parents before receiving an abortion. Mitch Jezerich reports from Washington, D.C.
By unanimous decision, the Supreme Court ordered a lower court to reconsider a New Hampshire law that requires parental notification 48 hours before a minor can obtain an abortion. The lower court previously struck down the entire law, but Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who wrote the opinion, says the law in general is constitutional, but it doesn't include an exemption for the health of the mother. The court has previously established that all abortion restrictions must include such exemptions. Still, Crystal Lander, with the Feminist Majority Foundation, says parental notification could end up endangering the lives of young women.
When I first heard the case, the first thing I thought about is, would I have told my mother if I got pregnant unexpectedly? And I was a good student. I would never want to disappoint my mother, and I probably would have done everything I could not to tell her, which may have meant I went someplace that may have not been safe. Now, for a lot of women, young girls who get pregnant, they do tell their parents, or at least their mothers. But for those who don't, there must be a reason why.
Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
The European Parliament today voted down a proposal to liberalize port services. This after a strike and stormy protest by dock workers on Monday. Tony Cross reports from Paris.
The Parliament today voted 532 to 120 against the plan, with 25 abstentions. The European Commission's plan had already been thrown out in 2003, leading European Parliament President José Borrell to accuse it of wasting time by not simply dropping the bill. Dockers' unions agreed with him. They organised a Europe-wide strike on Monday and a demonstration at the Parliament in Strasbourg, France, which police say left 64 officers injured and a hefty bill for damages. The overwhelming rejection isn't just because of labour agitation. Port employers opposed the bill, fearing it would hit their profits. The most controversial proposal was so-called self-handling, which would have meant that a ship's own crew could unload a vessel, giving rise to fears of massive job losses among dockers. Commission members say they'll work on new port reforms, possibly concentrating on alleged unfair competition between European ports. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
A French warship on its way to a ship-breaking yard in India is facing an uncertain future after it was found to contain high amounts of toxic asbestos. Binu Alex has more from Ahmedabad.
The journey of a decommissioned French warship, Clemenceau, to a ship-breaking yard in Gujarat is facing multiple problems. Last week, the Indian Supreme Court denied permission for the carrier to enter Indian waters. Then Greenpeace claimed the documents that the French government submitted to Egyptian authorities to obtain passage through Suez Canal misrepresented facts. Now the labor unions in India are using the controversy to highlight poor working conditions at the shipbreaking yard. They say the job fatally affects the workers due to contact with substances like asbestos and other toxic waste while dismantling the ships. In mid-sea, the ship now seems to be headed nowhere. From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Social movements in Argentina and Uruguay this week have been protesting a controversial pulp mill project in the border region between the two countries. Ashley Pellet reports from Montevideo.
The target of this week's protests is a proposed cellulose factory owned by the Finnish company Botnia. Although the proposed mill will be physically based in Uruguay, many people in Argentina's Entre Rios province are strongly opposed to the project, saying the factory will cause severe environmental damage in the shared border region. Protests on the Argentine side have grown in recent weeks as different civil society movements from the region have blocked the bridges and roads that lead to Uruguay from their side of the river. The left-wing Uruguayan government, led by Tabaré Vázquez, has been reluctant to stop the construction of the pulp mills and is currently undergoing confrontation with the Argentine government, which demands greater precautions in order to avoid potential environmental damages. According to Juan Carlos Villalonga, director of campaigns at Greenpeace Argentina, the proposed pulp mills will produce 1.5 billion tons of pulp annually and use technology that will destroy the ecosystems of Uruguay River. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Asta Pellet in Montevideo, Uruguay.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Democrats revealed their version of lobbying reform today. They say their proposal goes further than the two Republican proposals released yesterday, but in all, details are minimal. Both parties are trying to save face in a government that has been riddled with scandal. As Leanne Caldwell reports from D.C., Democrats are attempting to label the Republicans as corrupt, while the Republicans say that they are the party of reform.
Today is the Democrats' turn. They released their version of lobbying reform. Led by House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, dozens of Democrats in both the House and the Senate appeared to be united behind a proposal they say would rid Washington of corruption, and they signed a declaration against it. Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi.
The Republicans have turned Congress into an auction house for sale to the highest bidder. You have to pay to play. That's just not right. Democrats are leading the effort to turn the most closed, corrupt Congress in history into the most open, honest Congress in history.
Yesterday, the Republicans, appearing not as united, revealed two different plans for reform, one in the House and one in the Senate. The urgent call for reform before Congress has come back to Washington for work comes after several corruption scandals dealing with corporate payouts and illegal lobbying tactics that have been uncovered in recent months. Duke Cunningham was convicted for receiving bribes from defense contractors, Tom DeLay was indicted for tax evasion, and lobbyist Jack Abramoff pled guilty to felony charges involving his lobbying practice. All the congressional proposals equals three that have been revealed so far, and all three overlap in many ways. They all say they will make government more transparent, accountable, and open. They will expand the time before former congressional staff can lobby their former offices and reform the travel and gift ban. But the topic of travel and gifts are where the differences begin. John McCain, leader of the Senate Republican proposal, says that bans on lobbyist-funded gifts and travel will just create dirty ways to get around them. He and Rick Santorum from Pennsylvania are instead calling for stricter regulation. Senator John McCain.
Transparency and disclosure, transparency and disclosure as the primary way of attempting to address this issue.
That proposal, along with the Democrats, also focuses on earmarks or pork barrel spending projects that are usually added at the last minute of large appropriation bills. For example, McCain said that the defense spending bill had 14,000 earmarks this past year with unrelated spending, compared with 4,000 in 1994. But the Democratic bill is the only one that mentions enforcement. House Minority Leader Pelosi called for the Ethics Committee to start investigating the corruption that has overcome the House. Larry Noble is Executive Director of the nonpartisan government watchdog group, Center for Responsive Politics. He says enforcement is key.
One of the reasons we got to where we are today is because you have in the House of Representatives an Ethics Committee that is, and this is being polite about it, is dead. It doesn't do anything. It actually hasn't met in over a year. And the Ethics Committee, even when it was active, was considered a joke. And in fact, the one time it slapped Tom DeLay on the wrist, its chairman was not reappointed to be chairman. And so when you have a culture that says enforcement of these laws is not important, in fact, it's frowned upon, you're going to get abuses.
The rest of the differences in the proposals become partisan. The Republicans want to dissolve the use of 527 groups, grassroots campaigning that doesn't have to report their political donations that are mostly used by Democrats. An example is MoveOn.org. And the Democrats want to dissolve the K Street Project, a network of lobbyists and lawmakers started by conservatives. But both bills do try to change the practices of lobbying, not the practice of lawmaking. Again, Noble.
They're focusing more on the lobbyists and not on themselves. I mean, one of the fair questions is, why do you accept these things? Yes, you can limit them, you can prohibit them, but why do you accept them right now?
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
According to the World Report released today by Human Rights Watch, new evidence indicates that torture and mistreatment were an intentional part of the Bush administration's counterterrorism policy. The report further indicates that human rights violations have been a deliberate choice by top U.S. government officials. Kevin Roth is the executive director of Human Rights Watch.
It's long been understood that the Bush administration's use of torture and inhumane treatment could not be blamed on a handful of low-level soldiers on the night shift. At minimum, we understood up until now that policy decisions taken at the top had created an atmosphere of tolerance for abuse. And among those policy decisions that one could cite would be, for example, the Bush administration's ripping up of the Geneva Conventions with respect to Guantanamo, its extraordinarily narrow definition of torture to the point that most forms of abuse were not considered torture, its assertion of so-called commander-in-chief authority, the supposed claim on the part of the president that as a commander-in-chief he could order torture, President Bush's repeated incantation of the claim that the United States would not torture while completely neglecting the parallel prohibition of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. And finally, the launching of a series of pseudo-investigations, none of which were independent and all of which looked down the chain of command, not up.
Kevin Roth of Human Rights Watch speaking in Washington, D.C. Human Rights Watch's World Report also indicates that countries like Canada and Britain, along with the U.S., have helped to undermine important international human rights protections, and that the European Union has ignored serious violations in countries such as China, Saudi Arabia, and Russia in order to forge relationships with those countries that may be considered practical for fighting terrorism. A full copy of the report can be found online at www.hrw.org. The trial of Saddam Hussein is set to resume this week, but the process has fallen victim to further dissension, with the head judge of the current proceedings, Rizgar Amin, resigning. Amin is expected to be replaced by a deputy. Figures from the former regime have been released from U.S. custody in recent weeks, while others are still hoping to be released. Salam Talib speaks with Badia Izzat, a lawyer for Iraq's former Minister of Foreign Affairs, Tariq Aziz, and files this report with David Enders.
Izzat also served as counsel to the recently released Hoda Amash and Rehab Taha, two female scientists who were in U.S. custody until late December. The release of female prisoners held by the U.S. military is a common insurgent demand. Like Amash and Taha, Aziz has yet to be charged with any crime. Izzat says he is pleading for Aziz's release on the grounds that his client, who is being held on a U.S. base at Baghdad International Airport, is near death.
I met with Tariq Aziz 2 weeks ago, and I met him again a few days ago. His health situation was not good, and he has problems concentrating and needs dentures, and the Americans did not provide them to him. He is about 70 years old now, and he was using one of the guards to help him walk. I asked him what he has, and he told me that he has heart problems, especially at night. He needs to be in a good health care facility, and the airport base is not a good place for that.
Izzat believes that Amin didn't see the case as strong enough to continue with and was afraid of the implications of a ruling for or against the defendants.
The judge decided that there is not enough evidence to put these people in jail, and he was afraid for his life if he decided to set them free. The new Iraqi government would maybe punish him, so he prefers to leave the case, and that will happen for others too, and he is not going to be the last one.
Izzat also criticized the case of Dajail, a village in which Saddam escaped an assassination attempt in 1982 and then exacted brutal revenge on the villagers, as a poor choice for beginning the prosecution when there were larger crimes at hand.
The government made a bad choice when they chose to begin with the Al-Dajail case, to begin trying Saddam and his government. But with that, I do not see the court as liable, because the decision was made by the occupation.
The trial is set to resume January 24th. I'm David Enders with Salam Talib, reporting for FSRN.
Ecuador has survived what is now considered to be the worst oil-related environmental disaster on the planet. While operating in the northeastern Ecuadorian rainforest, one of the most delicate ecosystems in the world, Texaco, now Chevron, openly dumped more than 30 times more oil than the total released in the infamous Alaskan Exxon Valdez spill. The Organization of American States has now demanded protection for the four leading plaintiffs in a trial against Chevron that has lasted over 12 years. Joseph Muti has more from Quito.
Alejandro Ponce, Ermel Chavez, Pablo Fajardo, and Luis Llanza have suffered death threats, an attempted kidnapping, military surveillance, and a robbery at one of their offices. They and the Ecuadorian Amazon Defense Coalition, representing 30,000 indigenous rainforest residents, are suing Chevron for the illegal dumping of 18.5 billion gallons of toxic waste, as well as for high levels of child cancer. The trial is being held in a community called Lago Agrio. Luis Llanza, one of the four the OAS has requested that the Ecuadorian government guarantee life and physical integrity, is the coordinator and most public figure in the case against Texaco Chevron. It was his daughter who was almost kidnapped in a recent attempt, he says, was to prevent him pursuing the case against the U.S. oil company.
These OAS measures represent an important signal to the court, the public, and above all Texaco, that it not be allowed to twist the outcome by any kind of strategy through abuse of its power to influence the final decision of the judge. But with or without protection, we will take this legal process to its end.
Stephen Donzinger, one of the lead attorneys for the Amazon Defense Coalition, is disappointed that it took intervention from the Organization of American States in an attempt to force the Ecuadorian government to protect the lead plaintiffs in the case against Chevron.
It's a shame that you have to go to an international body to force the government of Ecuador to provide the protection necessary to be sure that they do not get harmed and they're able to continue to exercise their right to bring the lawsuit.
The intervention of the OAS comes at the same time that contracts have been revealed between the Ecuadorian military and Chevron to provide security and housing for Chevron operatives involved in the trial. Luis Llanza is very clear about this connection.
Chevron Texaco operate from a military base near Lago Agrio. We believe that the threats against us are related to the association that exists between Texaco and the military.
I spoke by phone to Rodrigo Perez, who is an Ecuadorian attorney and spokesperson for Chevron in the case. He said that the Chevron officials are living in the army camp for their protection due to high instances of drug trafficking and criminal activity in the region. However, Donziger feels that in light of the threats against the Ecuadorian plaintiffs, Chevron should disassociate itself entirely from the Ecuadorian military.
We think this type of arrangement is completely inappropriate for a whole host of reasons. And we also believe that some of these threats have been exercised against the leaders of the trial are emanating from the same base where the Chevron lawyers are living. So, at a minimum, Chevron should get off that base.
Plaintiff Luis Llanza then explained that the defense presented by Chevron in previously providing for a $40 million cleanup operation is a complete fraud.
The corrective work they say they performed does not exist. Water and soil samples have been taken at those sites that Chevron says have been cleaned up. The results show high toxic levels.
Chevron spokesperson Rodrigo Perez defended the U.S. oil company by saying that Chevron was only a 37% minority partner of a consortium that included the state oil company Petroecuador. However, the Amazon Defense Coalition says that Petroecuador simply took over the operation from Texaco Chevron when it left the country in 1992, inheriting its faulty equipment and environmental policies. Steve Donziger is highly critical of Chevron's cleanup operation.
It was more a cover-up than a cleanup. They simply took dirt from the ground and ran it over pits full of toxic sludge without cleaning the pits out. You cannot live over a toxic waste pit without being exposed to carcinogens. We learned that from Love Canal.
Damages to the once pristine northeastern Ecuadorian rainforest are estimated to exceed $6 billion by the independent environmental firm Global Environmental Operations, a far cry from the $40 million Chevron claims was necessary for the cleanup. The trial could lead to the first verdict against a U.S. oil company in a third world country, and is seen by international environmental and human rights organizations as an important precedent involving issues of globalization, indigenous rights, and resistance to a powerful multinational corporation. For Free Speech Radio in Quito, I'm Joseph Muti.
Argentina's government has announced that the South American nation will form a new National Biodiversity Council this year. Environmental and Sustainable Development Minister Atilio Savino says the council aims to promote programs for the sale of environmental services. The Argentine government has also signed an agreement to form a joint biodiversity policy with neighboring Mercosur trade bloc nations. FSRN's Marie Trigona has more from Buenos Aires.
A key feature to Argentina's new biodiversity policy, with the support of the UN Environmental Program, is the sale of environmental services. Contrary to what the name suggests, through privatizing the environment, these services jeopardize Argentina's diverse and rich ecosystems. The government argues private environmental management services will facilitate companies to preserve ecosystems while providing jobs for local communities. Many local advocates say that the sale of environmental services will allow corporations to conduct harmful industrial activity in susceptible ecosystems and hotspots for biodiversity. According to Naomi Abad, director of Argentina's largest ecological awareness website, ecoportal.net, the trade of carbon credits serves as a loophole helping corporations evade emissions cuts.
The sale of environmental services is transforming the environment into another business. This would mean allowing companies that have money to pollute while those of us without resources continue in poverty. Instead of ceasing to pollute, develop countries that need to cut down on their carbon emissions to stop global warming by credits for emission from countries with native forests. And native forests are later replaced with fast-growth industrial tree species like eucalyptus and pine.
The carbon market is projected to become one of the largest markets ever, reaching $60 billion by 2008. Spain and Britain lead bids for carbon credits in Argentina. The World Bank's Carbon Finance Unit has financed specific carbon credit projects in Argentina. Through this program, the World Bank ensures developing countries become key players in the emerging global carbon market. Argentina's government offers bioprospecting as another environmental service. The University of Arizona has led biodiversity prospecting in Argentina, Chile, and Mexico. Javier Rodriguez Pardo, a leading environmental researcher and writer, considers bioprospecting synonymous to biopiracy.
Los laboratorios del primer mundo patenten un conocimiento.
The labs in the first world patent species without any participation from the local communities in the south, and much less from indigenous people. They are the ones who transmit this ancestral knowledge. Patenting is a way of acquiring and dominating knowledge, and that the people don't have any way to access it unless they buy the patent. Indigenous people end up paying for a drug patented in a lab from a pharmacist.
Que produce la patente laboratorio.
Royalties offered in bilateral bioprospecting agreements are typically less than 3% of the profits from products based on indigenous knowledge and resources. Communities in Argentina have moved to launch campaigns similar to those in Brazil and Chiapas against biopiracy and environmental services. Forest fires, flooding, and the spread of diseases like cholera and leprosy are just some of the immediate consequences of the government's environmental policy. In a report released last December, scientists concluded Argentina will lose half of its native forests in the next few years. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
There are fresh major developments to public education in New Orleans. Mayor Ray Nagin's Bring Back New Orleans Commission released the final plan to restructure the city, while the first of the city's downtown public schools, whose student body is predominantly African American, has reopened. FSRN's Christian Roseland has more.
I miss my school so much. I went here last year, and it was so much fun, and it was a great experience, and I wanted to come back so bad. I couldn't wait till school opened up. And then Katrina came, and we was out of school for all this time. I was crying to come back to my school, but I'm finally back, and I'm so happy, and I'm so glad that they decided to reopen the school.
Alicia Sharon travels every day across the Mississippi from the West Bank suburb of Marrero to attend McDonough 35 High School. Sharon lived in New Orleans East before the storm, but says that the commute from her new home is worth it to continue to attend the school, the second New Orleans public school to reopen, and the first in the city's low-income, majority black downtown neighborhoods. McDonough 35 principal Philip White says that 400 students currently are attending the school, and that he expects the number to rise to 800. McDonough 35 was a citywide magnet school before the storm, but White says that most students who apply can attend. Access to public education is slowly returning to New Orleans, where most of the public schools had been taken over by the state and many schools had become charters. Access to public education is slowly returning to the city, where most of the public schools had been taken over by the state and many schools had become charters. Before McDonough 35 opened Tuesday, many students whose parents could not afford private schools had limited options. Also on Tuesday, Mayor Ray Nagin's Bring Back New Orleans Commission's Education Subcommittee released its final report, which proposed a plan to restructure New Orleans public schools. The plan recommended a market-based approach. Scott Cohen, the president of Tulane University, an elite uptown college, and chairman of the Education Committee.
We want a lean center system. What we mean by a lean center system, we don't want a lot of overhead here. So we want to create something called the Shared Services Organization that delivers high-quality and efficient service options and treats schools as customers. But each particular function we should have, we should say, should we run that, or is it better outside?
The plan also included the creation of a National Advisory Board, which Education Commission members say has never been done in another city. The plan did not mention a timeline for reopening New Orleans public schools or bringing back the teachers who taught in them. Chewy Clark pointed out the disparity between private and public schools.
You know, we understand what's happening right now. You know, how they're refusing to open public schools like 35. First they tell them they had the money, but then you open the charter on the West Bank.
Also, many in the room were critical of the lack of attention to the displaced population, who were not represented in the Bring Back New Orleans Commission. Loretta Tate, parent of a local public school student, pointed out many of those displaced need other services as well.
And I'm a displaced resident,
in Houston, Texas, and I want to know, ask the Education Board, what are we doing for our children so far as counseling? Because Houston is not embracing our children in those school systems. And I need to know, what are we doing to get some counseling to those children? Nothing?
For Free Speech Radio News in New Orleans, this is Christian Rosalind with Myla Lieventhal.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and KPFK in Los Angeles. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Washington editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jay Paget-Seekins and Eric Klein. For more information or to get archives of this or any other newscast or documentary, you can visit our website at www.fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Paula Fogado.
This is Independent Native News for Wednesday, January 18, 2006. I'm Robert Hannon in for Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. The political fallout is spreading in the investigation into Washington lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Abramoff pleaded guilty to fraud and other charges earlier this month and has agreed to help in a federal bribery probe. Investigators are looking at several members of Congress and their aides. Now this week, the Associated Press reports ties between Abramoff and former House Majority Leader Republican Tom DeLay. DeLay is under his own political cloud. He faces court charges in a campaign finance investigation in his home state of Texas. In a 2001 letter to the Justice Department, DeLay urged the Attorney General to shut down a tribal casino that Abramoff wanted closed. Within months of that letter, a political action committee backed by DeLay received thousands of dollars from some of Abramoff's tribal clients. A spokesman for DeLay says the congressman was only looking out for the interest of his constituents. While the Justice Department didn't take action on the letter, the casino owned by the Alabama Coushatta tribe was shut down a year later by a federal court ruling in a 1999 lawsuit. Meanwhile, another key Republican leader in the House has stepped aside in the wake of the Abramoff investigation. Ohio Republican Representative Bob Ney has relinquished the chair of the administration committee. Ney has earned the nickname the Mayor of Capitol Hill since his committee controls office space and parking as well as other privileges. Ney denies any wrongdoing, claiming he's stepping down because the investigation is a distraction to him and the Republican Party. But the investigation targets Ney for agreeing to introduce and pass legislation that aided several of Abramoff's tribal casino clients in exchange for sizable campaign donations and a paid golfing trip. And in other news, the state of Wisconsin school superintendent is urging school districts to drop their native mascots and logos. Superintendent Elizabeth Burmaster's letter to the districts is getting praise from Native American groups. But as Gil Halstead reports, only a lukewarm response from some of the school districts who received it.
The letter from Superintendent Burmaster cites a resolution from the American Psychological Association that calls on schools nationwide to drop Indian logos and mascots. Psychologists say they create a hostile learning environment by promoting negative stereotypes. Burmaster says she supports bills in the legislature that would force schools to prove their mascots are not harmful or pay fines for not changing them. The bills have not gotten a hearing. The chair of the state Senate's Education Committee, Republican Luther Olson, opposes them. He lives in a city that still proudly cheers the Berlin Indians at his alma mater. Berlin school superintendent Jerry Runis says neither the name nor the mascot is controversial in his city, and Burmaster's call to change it isn't likely to have much of an impact.
The former state superintendent John Benson back in the early mid-90s sent us out a same type of letter. So we gather that as information if we ever have to use it, and I have a folder on it, and we will continue to put it in that folder and look at it as we need to.
The logos and mascots have been controversial in some school districts, prompting recall elections of school boards that tried to change them. Supporters of keeping them say it should be a local decision, not a state-mandated policy. Native American activists are glad to see the state superintendent take up the issue, but they'd like to see even more pressure on schools that still won't give up their logos. Harvey Gunderson of the Wisconsin Indian Education Association is fighting to get the Osseo School District to change its logo. He'd like to see high schools adopt a policy that many universities have, refusing to play preseason non-conference games with schools that have Indian logos.
That sends a very strong message to the community. You're really not doing something that we approve of here, and that's why we're not going to play you.
Gunderson has sent letters with that message to several school districts that have changed their Indian logos, urging them to put peer pressure on the teams they play with who have not. Gil Halstead, Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Robert Hammond.
Supported by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a native venture protecting Indian country's assets. www.amerind-corp.org. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Have you ever thought of all the things that you can do?
The Urban League of Portland presents the 4th Annual African American Youth Leadership Conference, Investing in Your Future, featuring keynote speaker Reverend Dr. W.G. Hardy Jr., workshops, panel discussion, and more. The event takes place Saturday, January 21st from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Portland Community College's Cascade Campus, Terrell Hall, located at 705 North Killingsworth in Portland. The event is open to all high school students. To RSVP, call 503-280-2600. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of this event.
As the sunset drops, introducing the night sky, the dust melts down and you ain't a blind eye. Brush deep, to the dude with the fly by. The view on my wide open, but stone high.